and that's maybe said often. But it gets very interesting when the non-judgmental awareness we're bringing is being brought to the judging mind. How are we non-judgmentally aware of our tendencies to be judgmental, to judge things as being good or bad or right or wrong, and are condemning and praising and blaming and all the things that we do with a judging mind. And I'm on my thought today in the last few days, because on this 10-day retreat that I just finished teaching down in Yucca Valley, that one of the days I had a series of interviews with the students, and there was a series of students who came in and talked about being plagued or troubled by their judging mind. And it was very painful. The experience of a retreat is varied from person to person. It's quite precious, and it's really beautiful. It's just a wonderful one. I think it's one of life's great events, is to go on retreat. But one of the things retreats do is to give you an undiluted experience of yourself, which some people would rather not. And so, because often in our normal life we find ourselves quite scattered or distracted from kind of some of the tendencies of our mind and heart. And one of the tendencies that some people have at times is to be very judgmental, be judging a lot. And to sit and have an undiluted experience of the judgmental mind just working itself and working and doing it, everything, is judging everything left and right, and our inner life, our outer life, can be quite wearing and tiring and painful. And it's seemingly getting in the way of being able to do the mindfulness practice, seemingly. And so it was a series of students who came and talked about their judgmental mind, their judging mind. I feel like I want to just, realizing that for some people it's a common visitor, common occurrence, and I think for all of us it appears at different times, and it's something to get to know and learn how to work with. And I think the judging mind is often painful, because a judging mind, as best as I can kind of sense it, understand it, the mind that's constantly judging and judging is usually a mind that's involved in aversion, in pushing things away. And it's almost as if judgment, I mean, there can be good judgment, you know, that's kind of, you judge something and you want it. But when its mind is really plagued by judgment, it seems like it's often judging things as being wrong or bad or being aversive to things. And in a sense, that kind of judging mind is akin to the other forces of aversion, that other manifestations of aversion, such as fear and boredom, which are interestingly all said to come out of aversion. And not only is it painful to spend a lot of time judging, it's also painful to be the object of judgment. So, I mean, one thing is for the judgment to be about other things outside of you. It's very painful if your judgments are towards yourself. And it's very painful for other people to receive the judgment, negative judgments that we have about them. So it's a very painful event. And part of what this aversion, part of what this judgmental mind does, is to create separation between self and other, between self and self, which is a very painful kind of form of suffering when we're separated from ourselves by our judgment. And it's, you know, as I understand the aversive judgments that can come, they often take the form of right and wrong, good and bad, which are rather simplistic judgments that have to do with concepts and ideas of value, and might not have anything inherently to do with actually what's going on. So, for example, you know, I'm kind of a tall guy. And that's just what's going on, right? Now, I might think, you know, it's bad to be tall, or it's wrong to be tall. Something's wrong with me because I'm kind of tall. I mean, that's a completely silly idea, you would think. However, the imposition of value on ourselves and our experience is very common. And it has nothing necessarily to do with the experience of what it is inherently itself. In looking at the at judgment, and what's kind of painful about judgment and how it gets in the way, how it's a movement away from freedom, it's useful to distinguish the judging mind from what's called in Buddhism usually discriminating wisdom. There's a place in mindfulness. Hopefully mindfulness is supposed to strengthen our ability to make discriminations, distinctions between things. Not discriminate against things, but to distinguish. It's called discriminating wisdom. To see clearly what's what in our environment and in ourselves. And in particular, when it's called discriminating wisdom, is to see clearly what it is that's to be able to distinguish between that which moves us towards freedom and that which moves us to entrapment, to clinging. To notice within us those forces within us that are conducive to becoming more compassionate, more loving, less reactive to the situations we find ourselves in, versus those movements within us that make us kind of spiral down train of reactivity. This is a very important part of Buddhist practice. And it's kind of a footnote to this, but a friend of mine taught mindfulness to, juvenile criminals or juvenile delinquents in City Hall up in San Francisco. And the way that he introduced mindfulness practice that got their attention was he said he was going to teach them how to have mind power. And that got their attention enough. I mean, forget about this, allowing things to be as they are. I mean, they're not going to understand that. However, in terms of mind power, one of the most powerful powers, that the strongest powers we can have of the mind, is the power to let go. And it's probably one of the most difficult things to learn, to let go, not to cling and to hold on to things. And the function of discriminative wisdom is to see what is appropriate to let go of and how, and what is appropriate to participate in. Actually, everything's appropriate to let go of, in terms of clinging, but not in terms of abandoning. It said, someone asked the Buddha to give his teachings in a nutshell. And you and all your enlightened disciples have spent all these years practicing and studying and refining your minds and your hearts. And you know, can you tell me after all this study and practice, what have you? I want to learn what you learned in one sentence. And the Buddha said, nothing at all is worth clinging to, as me or mine. Nothing at all is worth clinging to to hold just as me and mine. So discriminating wisdom is to help see clearly what's going on. There's a book called Mindfulness by a psychologist at Harvard named Ellen Langer. And it's a very nice little book. She spent her academic career studying mindfulness as a psychologist, without seemingly any connection to the Buddhist tradition. She claims that, at least. And it's a very wonderful book, very kind of straight, easy to read, and she does a lot of experiments and reports on a lot of experiments about that have to do with mindfulness and mindlessness and different environment situations. And she wanted to discover... she did an experiment with children, school children, little children, to see if they can learn to be more discriminating, distinguish between, make better distinctions between things, and not stereotype things into fixed categories so much as sometimes we do. And she gave them a whole bunch of exercises to do as part of training them. And then she had a control group where they didn't get got different kind of training. And one of the exercises was they would give these different groups of kids problems to solve. And in one group, they would tell them to come up with four different answers. And the other group, they'd tell them to come up with one answer. And most of us, when we see a problem, we think that maybe there's one answer is, you know, that what, you know, what we have to come up with. And there's maybe, we think maybe there is only one answer. You take the SAT and you have two answers that you think are right, and you're screwed. But, you know, life isn't an SAT test. So anyway, she had one group, the two groups given the same problem, and one group told to find four answers, and one group just to find an answer. And so they did this for a while, and then some other exercises. And then they took the two groups, and they showed them photographs, I believe, of handicapped people, people who are blind or handicapped in different ways. And then they were supposed to choose from the pictures people to be part of some kind of team sport that they were going to do. And what she found was that the kids who were told to give only one answer to their problem, they would, she distinguished between giving function-specific, making function-specific decisions and person-specific. And the people who only came up with one, trained to only find one answer to their problems, tended to categorize the handicapped people as these are handicapped people. And the people who were trained to kind of find four different answers to a problem, they didn't see a handicapped person. They saw a person who had a particular function that didn't work for this particular sport, but might have worked for another different sport. And so they didn't categorize the person as you know, the whole person that way. And that to me is a beautiful thing. And that's a function of maybe discriminating wisdom, to make those kind of fine distinctions and discriminations that allows us to see more options of how to respond in the world. And mindfulness practice is supposed to actually help us to make that kind of discrimination and to increase the number of optional ways that we might respond and problem solve in our life. I thought this was a very nice example. So discriminating wisdom, in the Buddhist sense, is a movement toward, is that wisdom or insight that helps us to move towards freedom. And the judging mind is that movement away from freedom towards unawareness. Because the judging mind in and of itself is an unaware, involves unawareness, involves ignorance, not seeing clearly. And the judging mind lends itself to mechanical reactions. And as I've been saying, leaves little room for creativity, leaves little room for peace, leaves little room for compassion or even realistic assessment of what the situation is. I have two little quotes that is maybe illustrating some of this. This is one that I read often because I like it a lot. And maybe it's an example of someone who doesn't make a decision reactively, as what, you know, in the ways that would be most obvious to most of us, but maybe has more discriminative wisdom of what's wise and compassionate to do, that has a much better, more useful maybe results than would come if we did the obvious thing, you know, call the police or. Abbot Anastasius had a book of fine parchment, which was worth 20 shekels. It contained both the Old and the New Testaments in full, and Anastasius read from it daily as he meditated. Once a certain monk came to visit him, and seeing the book, made off with it. The next day, when Anastasius went to his scripture reading and found that it was missing, he knew at once that the monk had taken it. Yet, he did not send after him for fear that he might add the sin of perjury to that theft. Now the monk went into the city to sell the book. He wanted 18 shekels for it. The buyer said, "Give me the book so that I may find out if it is worth that much money." With that, he took the book to the holy Anastasius and said, "Father, take a look at this and tell me if you think it is worth as much as 18 shekels." Anastasius said, "Yes, it's a fine book, and it's 18 shekels, it's a bargain." So the buyer went back to the monk and said, "Here is your money. I showed the book to the father Anastasius, and he said it was worth 18 shekels." The monk was stunned. Was that all he said? Did he say nothing else? No, he did not say a word more than that. "Well, I have changed my mind and don't want to sell the book after all." Then he went back to Anastasius and begged him, with many tears, to take the book back. But Anastasius said gently, "No, brother, keep it. It is my present to you." But the monk said, "If you do not take it back, I shall have no peace." After that, the monk dwelt with Anastasius for the rest of his life. Sometimes discriminating wisdom is slow to come. This is called autobiography in five short chapters. You know it? Maybe you all know it? It's been going around. You know, anyway, I walk down the street. You all know it? You know it well enough you can't stand? I walk down the street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I am lost. I am hopeless. It isn't my fault. It takes forever to find a way out. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I am in the same place. But it isn't my fault. It still takes a long time to get out. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it there. I still fall in. It's a habit. My eyes are open. I know where I am. It is my fault. I get out immediately. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. 5. I walk down another street. Discriminating wisdom. I had this quote also. It's from Shakespeare, As You Like It. And I remember, it's these two shepherds talking. And the first shepherd says to the other, "And how do you like this shepherd's life?" And the second says, "Truly, shepherd, in respect of itself, it is a good life. But in respect that it is a shepherd's life, it is not. In respect that it is solitary, I like it very well. But in respect that it is private, it is a vile life. Now, in respect that it is in the fields, it is pleasant. It pleaseth me well. But in respect that it is not in the court, it is tedious. As it is a spare life, look you, it fits my humor well. But as there is no more plenty in it, it goes against my stomach." And it goes, depends how you look at things, depending on the criteria, the context, and the values you have. So you can go back and forth. It's really great or it's awful. And judgments sometimes are like that. They're maybe somewhat arbitrary at times, and they have much more to do with what's going on within us than it has to do with the situation out there. So, and what's going on within us often enough, when the judging mind is active, is painful. It isn't that sometimes we just make a few random discriminations or, you know, make good judgments, and that's what we're supposed to do. But the judging mind, when it's kind of rampant, it's kind of like we become judgmentalists, and our religion is judgmentalism. You know, we made an ism out of judgments, and we're kind of lost and consumed by just judging and believing our judgments, and they seem to be, you know, all there is. Or we fall into the religion of wrongism. You know, that we believe our ideas of right and wrong, as if the right and wrong is inherently part of how the universe is made up, rather than just a kind of overlay of concepts, which might or might not be useful to overlay on a situation. And I think that a lot of our suffering might be traced to some kind of simple notion that something is wrong. Something is wrong with me. People, when they get sick, especially Americans, have this American work ethic. You know, you have to be working and being productive to be, you know, right. If you're sick, you're not working, and so then you feel wrong. You know, or being sick, you're responsible for being sick. Something you did something wrong in order to get sick. or dying. People, you know, feel, you know, they're dying. They, I did something wrong. I must have done something wrong when I was, you know, younger, or what did I do wrong? And it's a notion that something's wrong because you're dying. You know, maybe there's something unhealthy, you know, or something physically, you know, not right. But to impose a value judgment of right or wrong on what could be a natural process is to add extra suffering. One of the teachers at the retreat, Tara, she was talking a lot about wrong and how much suffering comes from our notions of wrong. And then she told a story of this somewhat older man who came on retreat with her. And he had the beginning of Alzheimer's, which for a lot of people is quite painful. Just the idea of it kind of is frightening. It's like what the word cancer was 20 years ago, 30 years ago, now it's Alzheimer. Everybody kind of, it's one of the greatest fears for many people. And he came on retreat, and he was a bit forgetful. But what was quite amazing for Tara about this man was how happy he was and how carefree and at peace he was. And he didn't seem to have any bitterness or any worries or any regrets or any concerns about, you know, having Alzheimer's. And so she commented on that with him. You know, what, this is kind of unusual. And how, why is it you have, you're so happy, and, you know, even though you seem to be kind of quite forgetful at times? And he said, oh, well, I have Alzheimer's, but I don't think anything's wrong about it. I don't think it's wrong. And I thought that was quite remarkable. Just, you know, it's something happening. And then Tara, in introducing this topic, she read this poem or this song from the American Indians. And I can't remember it so well, but it was something like, spring becomes summer, fall becomes winter. We born, we age, we die. Isn't it good to be part of it all? Isn't it good to be part of it all? And so we add, we impose on top of this, no, it's not good, it's bad. It's, you know, it's something, something's wrong here with me. Something's wrong, you know. And so what are some of the things we look at that we find in ourselves that is wrong? What are some of the things? Anybody want to admit some? Yes.
I have been off work on disability, some of you may have heard me mention, for almost a year, and I've spent, my largest struggle has been the one that you were talking about exactly, of feeling bad and worthless and all of these things because I'm not working, having no identity, because your identity, particularly in this area, is what you do.
Yeah. And then you might be lucky. Then you might be lucky enough to get a job, but it's not the right job. It's the wrong job because you're not making enough money to buy a house and have a mortgage and have three kids and a station wagon, two dogs and a cat and three mice. You know, we have. I mean, there's these ideals that society creates about what it is to be a right, successful kind of person. If we don't match those, there's some people have a tendency to see something's wrong with them. And thank you. And it's. One of the most difficult times of my life was when I was unemployed and couldn't find work. It was very painful. Yes?
I actually had a conversation with a friend of mine where we were talking about some of our coworkers who didn't care for her. All of a sudden, Colin says, God, I just hate judgmental people.
This is another quote that's been going around, so I apologize. I've heard it in so many different forms now, like people keep changing it, but this is the one I heard. One day a rabbi, in a frenzy of religious passion, rushed in before the ark, fell to his knees, and started beating his breast, crying, I'm nobody, I'm nobody. The cantor of the synagogue, impressed by this example of spiritual humility, joined the rabbi on his knees, saying, I'm nobody, I'm nobody. The custodian, watching from the corner, couldn't restrain himself either. He joined the other two on his knees, calling out, I'm nobody, I'm nobody. At which point the rabbi, nudging the cantor with his elbow, pointed at the custodian and said, look who thinks he's nobody.
Yeah.
So it's tricky, huh? I had a yoga teacher once, and talking about his philosophy for teaching yoga, he told the study of teaching young children ballet, and there was different styles of teaching ballet. And one style is there's a right and a wrong way, and you want to teach them exactly the right way. You know, you just get the form and the details just right. You know. And the other way is to be, you know, you teach them the forms, but you're kind of casual about it. And what they found following these kids, you know, up until their teenage or adult years, is that the ones who were trained to do it just exactly right according to form, they had the least creativity when they grew up and were cool dancers. And the ones who were given more leeway when they're kind of learning ended up being much more creative. One of the things, one of the common questions that people might ask or have asked when you talk about the judging mind and how painful and unnecessary it is, because the judging mind, our negative judgments, our criticisms, our condemning, our prejudice are really unnecessary, is one of the common questions is, well, if I don't have it, how will I take care of myself or how will I function in the world? And it comes, I believe, from, it comes out of from people who have very little sense of trust in their innate wisdom or their innate ability to respond appropriately in given situations. They feel they have to be defensive, they have to be aggressive, they have to be aversive in order to kind of cope in life. And I believe that one of the beautiful things that we can learn from letting go, the power of letting go from mindfulness, is we have a lot of resources within us, much more than many of us realized, to respond quite appropriately and quite intelligently, maybe even more intelligently, when we're not stuck in reactive modes of thinking, which is what judgmentalism is. So I want to talk a little bit about how to practice with the judging mind, how to include it as part of my field of mindfulness. And the first thing to be said, and probably the most important part in terms of mindfulness, is we bring a kind of spacious or allowing non-judgmental awareness to the judging. We feel the judgment, we sense it, we allow it to be there, just notice it. And the noticing of the judging mind is to begin seeing more clearly. It's begin bringing awareness. It's beginning to bring part of who we are that's non-judgmental to this place that's very tight and very painful. It's to bring some space and put some space around it. And that's very healing, just to do that. To judge our judgments is to go in the opposite direction, is to go further into the direction of being stuck and into a tight place. Yes?
A few days ago, a week ago, I was criticized by my boss. And, you know, kind of in the situation, it was, we were talking, you know, but when I came out, I really, for quite a few days, I struggled with, you know, judging me with her eyes, and then defending myself by judging her, and it always went back and forth, and I just couldn't get out of that, you know. It was really hard.
It's hard.
Caused quite some suffering. You know, it was either she had to be wrong or I had to be wrong. And either way, it was very painful.
So, being stuck in right and wrong thinking, mm-hmm. and you know, there's only one answer, and there's a right answer and a wrong answer, is a trap that can spiral out. But the first thing to do, I mean, is really just to see it as clearly as we can, and not to see if we can try not to add judgments on top of it, not to be just to feel the tendencies we have to be judgmental, recognize it, and then not be critical of it or not be defensive of it, but just see it for what it is. So this is the judging mind. And there's a Vipassana trick along these lines, which some teachers teach their students. And I had this idea that originated from Joseph Goldstein and his own practice, trying to cope with his own judging mind. And this is to count your judgments. And in the course of, you know, a day or something. And and you know, you get up to 322. And that's what happens. Some sooner or later, you know, maybe it takes, you know, 10,055, you know, or sooner or later you begin, oh, you know, not taking it quite as seriously. Because you can't take it too seriously when your numbers get really high. And you get kind of a lighter feeling into it. And this lighter feeling, kind of allowing it to be there and not making such a big deal of it, and not being so taking it being so heavy and so serious and so important, is beginning to loosen it up. And part of the problem with the judging mind is the judging mind is often so tightly involved and so tightly connected to what it's judging and where the pain that's coming from, the pain from which judgment is coming from. And to begin allowing it to be there and see it clearly for what it is without adding anything to it is to begin loosening it up and to begin separating ourselves from this tight space that we've gotten ourselves around it. So humor helps for sure, so counting. So somehow allowing it to be there. However, then after the allowing, or to whatever degree of allowing we can allow for, the next thing that can be done is to investigate it, to study it, study this phenomenon more carefully, study the judging mind, the judging heart, what's it all about. And one of the things to study, one of the things to investigate, is the tone of the judging voice within us. Is it sweet and friendly? You know, or is it, you know, a little bit, is it harsh and hard? And what is the tone of it? And if you feel the tone and sense the tone, that can often be a key for how to find a little bit more allowing space to allow it to be. You might then, you feel that it's harsh, or feel that it's painful, or feel that it's grating, is you kind of go and feel in your body, in your mind, or in your wherever it might be in your heart, you feel where that harshness might reside, that hardness might reside. And you simply bring your mindfulness to that feeling tone, that sense of it in the body, and just hang out with it, allow that to be. Make lots of space around that, lots of allowance, and see what happens as you do that. And it can often be very, very revealing to pay attention to the feeling tone. And you realize, you know, partly one of the things you realize is how painful it is to be in judgmental mode. You might be totally justified in judging someone, you know, and I mean, being justified is like adding, you know, matches to gasoline. So you're totally justified. But if you pay attention to the feeling tone of how it is to have those kinds of thoughts, you'll feel it, the cost it is to yourself, how painful it is to be involved in it. More interesting, perhaps, or as interesting, is to study the intention or the motivation behind judging, or to ask it another way, to study what is a judging trying to accomplish. We often take, you know, the judgment for granted, or just the end, you know, it's the end result. We've gotten this place, and we just judge left and right. But I take it to be partly a symptom, and partly an effort to try to accomplish something. And if we try to see what are you trying to accomplish when you're being judgmental, you might find that there's something really important that's motivating you to be judgmental to begin with. So on this retreat, when one of these people came and talked about their judgmental-ism, I mentioned that they should become friends with their judgments. And they kind of raised their eyebrows. And they thought that was kind of weird. I don't know what they were thinking, but maybe they thought that was, you know, hard to do or difficult to do or kind of a silly New Age idea. Or you know, be friends with my harsh critical thinking, my harsh judgmental. But then I ask the person, what are you trying to accomplish when you're being judgmental? And this person was actually able to discriminate between different kinds of judgmental movements. And the person said, when I'm judging the external other people, I'm trying to do one of two things. I'm either trying to make connection, or I'm trying to enhance myself, my ego. And connection, you can see in various ways. One way is if you're sitting around with friends and you're judging everybody else who's not there, there's all this kind of sense of camaraderie and energy and enthusiasm. You know, you really feel like, oh, that person's a no good, lousy, whatever. And yes, that person's no good. Yes, you know, it's like a cheerleading. You know, like you know, and you feel really all this energy and you feel good because you're energetic and you're kind of more alive and you really met another person. The other person knows where you're at and you're there together and it's just, you know, a great thing, right? So you make connection. So the person wants connection. And the other, so we talked about that a little bit. I said, well, actually, wanting connection with others, that's a beautiful thing. But the judgmentalism, I would argue, is a maladaptive attempt to try to get that. One way to see judgments as being a friend is to see them as fingers pointing back at something that's beautiful about you, that's healthy and appropriate. And so when next time a judgment arises and you see that's because you want to have connection, relax for a moment and feel that motivation to have connection and then sense, what is the best way to do this? We tend to be so mechanical, you know, in the habits we've learned. And then if you ask, well, if what you want is connection, what is the healthiest way? Because sharing judgments about other people might create in the moment a kind of a lot of energy. But in the long term, you're actually alienating yourself from everyone, including yourself, and you're not really making for healthy relationships. So if you want healthy relationships, you relax back into that desire for connectedness. See, well, how else can I do this? What else can I do? And you might find... So that's how you make judgments a friend. You're like, oh, there's a judgment. Oh, let me study this. Oh, what I want is connection. What's the best way of doing that? Oh, it's not to judge. It's to... You know, maybe it's to share some beautiful quality of the person I'm talking to and say, by the way, you know, I really enjoy it when you're this way, or whatever. The other was to enhance, the other person said, the other is to enhance the ego. Now, being egotistical is, you know, a wrong thing, isn't it? So, but what, to enhance the ego, so what's that about? You ask, what is enhancing the ego trying to accomplish? Well, I'm trying to protect myself. Oh, and why are you trying to protect yourself? I'm trying to protect myself because I feel kind of vulnerable. And what's wrong with being vulnerable? Well, I've learned from my life experience that I've decided from some early traumatic experience that I'm never going to put myself in a vulnerable position again because I was so burned when I was a kid or whenever that I'm not going to even get close to that kind of vulnerability. So I'm going to protect myself. But if you follow the chain of things back to the vulnerability, you might find that that's really a beautiful part of who you are. And you might, and slowly, if you can feel, and you might feel the pain. You might feel the tremendous pain of and fright and fear of being vulnerable. And you know, there's a good reason why we want to protect ourselves. But as we become willing to stay with the pain and stay with the hurt and stay with the vulnerability, we might find we can rest in this beautiful part of who we are, this tenderness. And so the judgment then becomes another kind of finger, in an indirect way, pointing back to a kind of tenderness that we've long lost a touch with. So that we talked about this, and I told this person the story that Jack Kornfield told me, and I've told here once, I think. But I think it's a beautiful story. At least parts of it is true. It'd be nice if all of it was true. But if all of it isn't true, then we can just call it a nice myth. The myth, you know, have a lot of truth in them. And this is the story of these Japanese soldiers who were left behind in the Philippines at the end of World War II. You probably read about in the papers, you know, 20 years ago that periodically after World War II, well, in World War II, the Japanese left these soldiers in the Philippines, in the jungles and the islands there, and told them to go, you know, fight the war until we come and get you. And they forgot to tell them the war was over. So they stayed there, and they would find them, you know. The last one they found was something like 1972 or 75, like almost 20 years after World War II. And the guy was still out there in the jungle and fighting World War II, or basically hiding. He wasn't fighting anyone, but he thought the war was still continuing. And the way Jack Kornfield tells the story is, what was very interesting was what the Japanese government did when it was discovered there was a soldier still back in the jungles of the Philippines. They would pull out of retirement the most senior living Japanese army officer from World War II, and he'd put on his best uniform and put on his sword and all. And he would take him to the jungle, and he would go walking through the jungle, I guess, and calling out, you know, come out, come out. And the guy would come out. And then the first thing that the general would do is he would bow down deeply in respect to the soldier and thank him for all the service he's done and for the country and, you know, for all these years. And he wouldn't tell him the war was over. He just, you know, thank him so much for his many, many years of dedicated service. And then they would take him back on a boat to bring him back to Japan. And on the boat, he would be treated as kind of a hero and honored and respected. And then as he got closer to Japan, they would mention, oh, by the way, the war is over. And by the way, it's been over for some time. But they wouldn't laugh. They wouldn't make light of it. They would actually give him tremendous respect and honor him for what he did. And then he'd come back to Japan. He was treated as a hero and given his medal and whatever. And I think the idea of honoring the person is really beautiful. And the metaphor, the analogy is that many of us are fighting wars which are long over. And, you know, we've been fighting it since we were children, or fighting it since whatever. And the war's over. But what's interesting is what they do. They don't laugh, they don't despair, they don't ignore it. What they do is they offer their deep respect. And basically, thank you for the service that you've done me. And it's really remarkable. I meet these people, you know, in interviews and retreats and other places. And I hear sometimes about the childhood pain, difficulty that they had. And the choices they made to protect themselves, the kind of personality, personas they put on, sometimes are probably the wisest or the only possible solution that the child could have done under an impossible situation. But then it gets kind of fossilized, or become kind of stuck in that mode, and so then we carry it with us long beyond the painful situation. 20, 30, 40, 50 years later, we're still operating as if we're protecting ourselves against this, you know, impossible situation. But actually, it's long been over. And so we can feel that. So the judgmentalism can be one of the signs, other things also. But excessive judgmentalism, and you feel that maybe it comes out of fear, or it comes out of hurt. And what does the fear come out of? What does the hurt come out of? What does the desire to protect oneself come out of? You can follow it back sometimes, not analytically, because mindfulness is not psychoanalysis. You don't have to go back to your childhood and understand these things. But you simply, by paying attention and turning the mirror of mindfulness back and looking carefully at first a judgment. What is this judgment? What is the intention here? What are you trying to accomplish in the moment, right now? And what's that? What is it arising out of? It's arising out of hurt, out of fear, out of sense of protectedness. And having strength and the courage, the willingness to hang out and feel that part of yourself that's in the present moment that hasn't really been attended to. Because if you're excessively lost in judgments and criticisms, deciding things are right or wrong or good and bad, you're not necessarily in touch with the deeper wellsprings of suffering and tenderness and compassion and love that could be buried within this kind of layer of abstractions and concepts that we sometimes live in. One of the things that judgments do, as this woman pointed out, it enhanced herself. And it enhances the sense of I am someone special. And the idea of separation, you know, me versus them, us versus them. Judgments are very powerful. And it isn't just individuals who do it, but But it's whole nations that do it, you know, or subgroups within cultures that do it to, among each themselves. Create judgments in order to have judgments in order to maintain senses of separation, sense of being special and elite. So judgments. I hope that those of you, when you are visited by, you sign up for judgmentalism, you know, become a member of this ancient cult, that you study it, get to know it, take it seriously, honor it, respect it, bow to it, make it your friend. And the way to make it your friend is to be spacious with it and see it as a finger pointing to something more essential about yourself. So what is more essential? Yes?
Gil, at the retreat, I was at the first 10 days before you got there. And I think it was James or somebody gave talked about the Buddhist talk on, I think it's called the double arrow talk. And that had a lot of meaning for me. And I saw how it comes up in so many aspects of life, whether it's your health or emotions. When you're talking about the judgment, that in a way that's an arrow, a wound, to be judgmental, and then our reaction to that of getting upset or trying to fight the judgments, and the way that we tend to habitually try to get out of that, it's really another wound. And at the point that we wake up and stop shooting additional arrows on ourselves, this is, you know, the time that the potential for healing is reawakened. And so I've been thinking about that a lot. That had a lot of I didn't hear that particular talk, and it just resonated in a lot of levels. You know, we do that with our health, the way we react to things,
right?
The way our bodies fight things. So seemed to fit here too.
Very well, yeah. And we're lucky if we only have two arrows. You know, there's another arrow story, and that is the man who was struck by the arrow, and then the doctor comes and he says, "Well, I don't want you to take out the arrow until I know the age and the caste and the village and the background and the profession and of the person who struck hit me with the arrow, the archer." And the doctor says, "Well, by the time I find all those things out, you're going to be dead." And sometimes too much analysis, trying to understand too much can make the wound fester and get worse. And that's where the tremendous power of just bringing awareness to what is actually happening in the present moment. Just that. Just tremendous power. You don't have to, you know, to analyze can be just... philosophize this can get very much in the way. I'm afraid, you know, we need to stop. It's actually quite late, so if you want, you can ask, come up and ask. So thank you all, and I hope I did right.